So chapter 30 and 31 in the book of Numbers tonight. Chapter 30 has to do with the taking or making of vows. And chapter 31 wraps up the story of Balaam, the son of Beor. So we'll come back and look with me at chapter 30, verse 1. Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord and swears an oath to bind himself to some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." The Lord is continuing to lay down several different concepts and ideas of how he wants Israel to live once they cross over the Jordan River and are in the promised land. They're getting ready to go and establish it. He's kind of wrapping things up and he's reiterating things and he's reminded them of things that they've already covered. The issues of vows has been covered before, but he covers it in detail here and brings up something extremely important, and that is that he wants his people, the people of the nation of Israel, to be men and women of their word. They are never in the Bible are we required to take a vow. Never does God say to us, you need to take a vow. In fact, if anything, Jesus encouraged us not to take vows, not to take a lot of vows anyway, but to be men and women of our word. If I say to you, I promise I'm going to do it. If I say to you, I'm going to get done tonight on time, I promise I'm going to be on time. What does that tell you about me? It tells you I haven't been on time a lot, because I have to say, I promise I'm going to be on time. So when you have to take and make a vow, it says something about your character. It says, I need to reassure you. I know this isn't generally like I am, but I want to reassure you that I will do this, that I'm really committed to this. I promise, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. Which what awful things for us to say as kids, by the way, right? Do you guys say that when you were kids? Cross my heart. Whatever that probably means, I don't know exactly what it means, but can't be good. Cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. It's funny, I never even thought about that as a kid, but now when I go over it, I think, wow, the things that we said, the vows that we took. Jesus tells us that he just wants our yes to be yes and our no to be no. Now, there are certain people who say, well, then if Jesus said that, let your yes be yes and your no be no, then I'm not going to take a vow. I won't go into a courtroom and I won't put my hand on a Bible and I won't take a vow, or I won't stand before an altar and take a vow with someone because Jesus told me not to. He was encouraging us to be men and women of our word. He wasn't saying that we couldn't take a marriage vow or that we wouldn't make a vow in front of a judge. He was saying, let what you say stand on its own. And then, if you are to be men and women of your word, how much more your marriage vow? If Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, how much more when you stood before the Lord as a witness to someone and said, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, until death do us part. When you take a vow, the vow is even stronger if we are men and women of our word. And we enter into a contract when we say, I'm going to pay those credit cards. If you lend me the money, I'll pay it back to you. We ought to pay it back. Well, years ago, when I left Albuquerque, I left a manager in charge of my business. I'd started 3 or 4 businesses by the time I came out here. They were auto upholstery businesses. They were fine when I was there. Running an auto upholstery business, having a present owner, manager owner is one thing. Having an absentee owner and manager in an upholstery shop is not a good idea. And so a couple of things happened. One of them is that we were collecting taxes from the people who worked for us. And then our bookkeeper cut the check and stapled them to the form and gave the envelope with a stamp on it. The guy that was managing it just never opened up from the bookkeeper and looked at it, never put that stuff in the mail, and never sent it out to the IRS. So we fell behind to the IRS $17,000 of money that we had collected from people to pay to the IRS. Now, the IRS is somewhat nice to you when you don't pay your own taxes. I don't know how true that statement is, but I can tell you when you collect taxes for other people and you keep it yourself, they don't like you at all. And within a matter of just a few years, a couple of years, penalty and interest on that money went to $56,000. I didn't find out that we had any problem until it was already around $30,000. When I found out that we had a problem, I just shut the shop down. I just thought, I'm going. And by the way, I was taking the money. I was calling up the guy managing and said, so, well, what do we do this week? And how much do we do? And how much money do we have in the bank? Well, you got a couple $1,000s in the bank? Well, send it to me. Put it in my account. So I was taking the money. Later on, I had to say to the IRS, well, what'd you do with the money you collected from the people? I just kind of spin it. I didn't mean to. They didn't care that I didn't mean to, but I had taken that money. And when we shut down the shop, then all of a sudden I realized we had material bills that had not been paid. There were just some other outstanding things. And I talked to my late wife and said, hey, I don't know what to do. Maybe we need to file bankruptcy. Maybe I don't know what we need to do. I don't know what to do. That you can't, filing bankruptcy didn't do anything with the IRS money, by the way. That was the biggest bill. And to make a long story short, we decided, you know what? We owe these things. Let's pay them. We called some of the people that we owed money to and just said, listen, this is what we make. This is what we're paying the IRS. And I'll pay you, $100 a month, but I can't pay more than that. And I'll pay off the bill. They weren't happy, but what were they going to do? they couldn't really come after me. They weren't happy about it. But we did pay them all off just because we felt like it was necessary. It made times really tough when our kids were small to make that stand. But I really felt that if I didn't make that stand while I was pastoring the church, that at some point it could come back and hurt the work that we were doing for the Lord. That at some point people would say, well, he hasn't kept his word, he hasn't done it, and God honored it, and it was difficult, and it was tough, but we were able to make it through. And I just kind of give you that story to encourage you. It might be tough to keep your word. It might be difficult. It might mean that your marriage may be just an absolute disaster from your perspective. It might not be good at all right now. I realize that there are reasons to separate. I realize there are reasons to divorce. But your marriage may be an absolute mess right now. And God would say, honor your word. Keep your vow. Show and be committed in love to the person that you are married to. And I believe that God honors our vows, especially when we say, Lord, I'm going to do it. There's a guy by the name of Jephthah. You remember him? He took a stupid vow. He was in the middle of a battle, and he said, Lord, whatever comes out of my house, I'll sacrifice to you if you let me win this war, this battle. My theory is that he had a dog he didn't like. Ran out of the house every time he came home. And he said, Lord, I'll sacrifice whatever runs out of the house to you. He won the battle, he went home, and his daughter ran out of the house. Now, there's another vow. Remember Saul took a vow? That Jonathan went off and started a war, a battle with the Philistines. They were already in battle line. They were lined up against each other. And Jonathan kind of thought, God could save with many or one. So he said to his armor bearer, let's go get him. See what God does. They went to get him. God gave him into their hands. And Saul woke up and looked over and saw this battle happening without him. He was the king. And Saul didn't know what to do. He had to sound like a king. So he said, if anybody eats today until we win this battle, then I'll kill him. Now, what a stupid vow. Your army's fighting. Who knows how long the battle's going to go. Now they got to go without food all of the time. And so at the end, he says, who ate food? And Jonathan said, well, I didn't know you made the vow, and I took some honeycomb and I ate it. And Saul says, well, I'm going to kill you. And the people intervened with the king. The people stepped in and said, no, this is not going to happen today. Because you aren't the one that led us into this battle, but your son Jonathan led us into this battle, and we are victorious today because of him. It would have been better for him, this man, Jephthah, to have broken his vow, to have said, God, I'm sorry, I won't sacrifice my daughter to you. He did sacrifice his daughter, if you know the story, by the way. He sacrificed it. It would have been better at that point for him to break the vow than it would have been for him to keep the vow. For us, what it says is, look, just don't take vows that you don't need to. Don't make vows that you don't need to. Don't promise God that you're going to do something that you don't do. Instead, in your heart, decide to do something. Maybe ask God, help me to do this. But don't take vows unless you can fulfill those vows to God. Whether it's Old Testament or New Testament, there's an honoring of our word and an honoring of vows that are taken. You know that God even took a vow in the Old Testament? The Bible says that God swore by himself. The New Testament says that God swore by himself because there's no one greater than himself. When God takes an oath by someone, who's God going to take an oath to? By you? He takes it by himself. So in verse 3 it says, and if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and the agreement by which she bound herself, and the father holds his peace, then all the vows shall stand, and every agreement with which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father overrules her on that day that he hears, then none of the vows nor her agreement by which she has bound herself shall stand. For the Lord will release her because the father has overruled her. I like that. I wish that I could have, you know, undid all the vows that my kids, I wish I could have undone a lot of the vows that my kids did when they were youth. Vows to play on a basketball team or a baseball team or soccer or to play an instrument or to be a part of the dance club, which all it did was complicate our lives. I would have loved to have said, no, you're free from that vow. That's what he says. That if they take a vow, it's going to indebt the father as well as the daughter. And the father can come in and say, no, that's not good. Or the father can oversee a vow that goes on. And I kind of like this concept. I like this concept because I have a heavenly father. And I, at times, am a little rash in making vows. I don't want to say that God, you know, is going to cover us and let us out of the vow. The young girl doesn't makes the vow, but she didn't have to keep it because her father says, no, that's not a good vow. And I think there's sometimes like Jephthah, not necessarily that kind of a vow, but there's a vow that we've made that's just a foolish vow, and we should just go to God and say, God, I'm sorry that I've done this. Forgive me and cover me for this, and I'm not going to make vows anymore. By the way, I think that we shouldn't make vows. I don't think we should bind ourselves in anything. And sometimes we want to boycott something because whatever it is, whether it's Disneyland or that's been boycotted by Christians in the past, or Circle K, which has been boycotted by Christians in the past, I've never gotten involved in those. Not that I don't believe in the cause, because I do. I believe in the cause. But I don't want to take a vow and then be driving down the road on an empty tank and have a Circle K there. I said I wouldn't go to Circle K ever again in my life. And I'm out of gas. There's just no reason. There's already enough that we have freedom. There's just no reason for us to block those things off, to make those kind of stands. In fact, I think it would be better for us as Christians in the day that we live in to show love, even though, remember, it was a boycott because Circle K sold pornography. It was a boycott against them because of that. But it would be good for us to show love to them. As Christians, maybe to say, let's all go to Circle K and let's all, you know, buy our sodas and our whatever, bags of chips or whatever we're going to buy. And every one of us, let's tell them about Jesus. Every single one of us. Let's just go in and love them. Disneyland was boycotted because of their stand on homosexuality. I didn't remember what the details were about it. I just remember that was the main thing. How much better for us as Christians to say, let's go show our love for Christ. Let's say we believe the Bible speaks against that, but we love them. We don't love the sin, but we love them. We don't love people who are involved in heterosexual sin either, but we love them. How much better for us to go and show our love? Maybe even to have a day where we all said, let's just all go to Disneyland and just smother the place. Let's all find somebody there that we can just tell them, you know what, the Lord loves you and we're here for Christ. And how much better for us to take that road? That, and so if we want to organize something, let's organize something in the positive. Now, that's my personal opinion. And you can take it for what it's worth. You can take it for what it cost you, for my opinion, okay? Which, in nothing, right? You didn't pay nothing and it might be worth nothing. I'm just saying, for myself, I don't want to bind myself. I don't want to restrict myself. Doesn't mean that I don't think that whatever they're trying to stand against isn't a worthy cause. But I just think, again, this is an opinion of mine. I just think we ought to be known for the world for what we are about and love, and not for what we stand against. It seems like we're so quick to let the world know what we're against and not about the love that Christ has for them and really winning them over into Christ. And that's my soapbox. I'm going to get off of it, and we'll get back into our study now. So the father delivers her from the vow, and if you've made a foolish vow, that's a sin, that would be a sin to keep, then I think it's better for you to just go to your father. So, Lord, I made a vow, and I need out of it. I'm sorry. Rather than keeping the foolish vow like Jephthah. If indeed she takes a husband. Now, this is a different culture than ours, okay? It's a old culture where men went out and did the work and women didn't. In our culture, more and more, the women is carrying as much of the financial responsibility in a home as a man does. In some cases, even more so, right? You guys are all starting to scowl at me, you gals. You smile at me a little bit now, making me nervous here. So we're looking at a different culture where that wasn't the case. And so a woman here would be, well, responsible to her husband as well. And to her husband, and makes no response to her on the day that he hears it, then the vow shall stand, just like the father, and her agreements by which he bounds herself shall stand. But if the husband overrules her on the day that he hears it, he shall make void her vow which she took and what she uttered with her lips by which she bound herself, for the Lord will release her. And I don't know if Kathy's watching this now, but you should take note of this passage. Kathy's my wife, by the way. Verse 9, also any vow of a widow or a divorced woman by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. If she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an agreement with an oath, and notice that again, she binds herself by the agreement or the oath, and her husband heard it and made no response to her and did not overrule her, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband truly made them void on the day that he heard them, then whatever proceeded from her lips concerning the vow and concerning the agreement to bind her, it shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and the Lord will release her. Notice that it's the Lord that releases the vows. It's not, you know, who they had promised that they would pay, who would release them, but it's God that would release them from those vows. For you and me, ultimately, when we take a vow, we bind ourselves before God to make those vows. So we could go to God and say, Lord, I made a stupid vow here, and I'm sorry. But we have to also be men and women of our words. And most importantly for you and me as Christians is our testimony and our witness. So if to the world we say, well, you know, I took a vow, but it was a foolish vow, and God's released me from this, they might go, well, I'm never going to go to Christ. I'm never going to commit myself to Christ. I've known a Christian who's done this, and I've known a Christian who did that. And I had a Christian who did this. We need to really consider the people around us for the sake of our testimony and keep those vows. But it's God who releases them. Every vow and every binding oath to afflict her soul, her husband may confirm it, and her husband may make it void. Now, if her husband makes no response, whatever to her day for that day, then he confirms all of her vows and all of her agreements, and that bind her. He confirms them because he made no response to her on the day that he heard them. But if he does not make them void after he heard them, they shall bear the guilt. These are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses between a man and a wife and between a father and his daughter in her youth in her father's house. So again, this is some 1,800 years before the time of Christ. It is for them living in those days. Another cultural difference for them was that they were living in a warlike community. And there's a battle that takes place in the next chapter. And it's disturbing to us when we read it. I could just read it, and I've heard pastors do this before. I could just read this chapter and pretend like it's not disturbing, just kind of go through it and then kind of move on. But I want to follow the one true living God, and I want to try to get all of what I can get from the scriptures by being honest about them. When we approach this chapter, I think that we need to realize that there's a spiritual part of it. The Bible says that all the things that happened to them while they were wandering the wilderness were examples to you and me. So these things are examples to us. And there's an example in this chapter that, again, living in a different culture, and we'll talk a little bit about God's judgment here in chapter 31. But it's a tough chapter. Verse 31. You guys ready for it now? After that introduction. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take vengeance on the Midianites. For the children of Israel, afterwards you shall be gathered to your people." Two things there in verse 2. Number one, take vengeance on the Midianites. God said, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." You and I are not to take vengeance. God will do it. David, in a few of the Psalms that he wrote, had this idea that if he took vengeance on somebody, that God wouldn't do it. And if he defended himself, that God wouldn't defend him. I think that's a good place for us to be. To say, you know what? People that have mistreated me, I'm just going to let God deal with them. And even pray that God would be gracious to them. But let God deal with them. And if there's any vengeance that has to be taken care of, God said, "Vengeance is mine. I'll repay." Now that ought to encourage us, on the other end of the spectrum, to be as fair to people as we could possibly be. We don't want to cheat people out of things. We don't want to put God in a position of taking vengeance on us at all, right? I've said it often, and I really think it's true. What God cares about for you the most is how you treat people. If you mistreat people, the Bible says the mercy you give is the mercy you'll receive. The judgment you judge with is the way that you're going to be judged. If you don't forgive, then you will not be forgiven. And we don't want God on the other side. We don't want to mistreat somebody and have God go, "I'll take care of them." Talking about Robert. Somebody said, "Don't you worry about what Robert did to you. I'll take care of him." Even worse yet might be, "He's my son. I'll take care of him. I'll get him later." Like when my dad was like, you know, "Just wait till you get home, son." Oh, no. That's exactly what God does with us. But as his children, it's out of love because he's going to correct us. But God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." And when somebody does something really to you that is really out of line, you got to be able to give it up. You got to be able to give it up anyway, because otherwise the bitterness is going to tear you apart. Years ago, I had a little Samurai Suzuki. You guys remember those things? I don't even know how I got the car. I think it was my sister's, and I think I bailed her out of her car loan by taking over the payments on it. But I took it to Jiffy Lube to change the oil. They changed the oil. They didn't put any new oil in it. They took the old oil out, capped it back up, and gave me the car. I drove down the road, and it blew up. And I, you know, went back to them and said, "Listen, the car's in the shop now, and they didn't have any oil in it." And they said, "Well, we don't know that." And I said, "I just left your place. I drove it there, and I drove it away." And they said, "Well, we're going to have a mechanic look at it." So they had a mechanic look at it. And then they said, "Well," and the mechanic said, "Well, yeah, it blew up because there's no oil in it." Gave a little paper, wrote out, you know, blew up because there was oil in it. And then they said, "You know what? We don't know. You might have drained the oil out. We're not going to pay for it." So I decided, you know what? I'm going to take them to court. Now, I don't know. You know, this isn't, you know, the Bible says Christians shouldn't sue each other. I was thinking, I'm not suing a Christian, but I'm going to take them to court. This isn't right. I owe the IRS a bunch of money anyway. I can't pay for this blown up motor. It was during that exact time that this happened. And I went to court, but I couldn't afford a lawyer. So I went myself. I thought, I'll take care of it. I could have been a lawyer in another life. I'll take care of the situation. So I went, and the lawyer for them was very nervous when I got there. Kind of saw, and they were talking, and they were shaking. Their hands were shaking when they were moving the papers. I don't know if they were a new lawyer or not, but I thought, you know, boy, they're in a lot of trouble. And judge calls me up for me to tell them what happens. And then I said, she goes, "Well, what do you have evidence you have?" And I go, "Well, I've got this paperwork here from a mechanic. They paid for it." And they go, "Objection. Did you hearsay?" And the judge goes, "Yeah, it's hearsay. You can't submit that." She goes, "You got to call that mechanic to the stand." And I go, "Well, I didn't know that." And she goes, "Do you have any other evidence?" "No." "Okay, well, then I rule for them." Boom, and she's done. And it's all over. And I go, "Well, can I reschedule?" She goes, "No, it's done. It's already completely over." I can't tell you in the process of that 3 or 4 months how much sleep I lost. Over the whole thing, it ate my gut. And finally, you know what I had to do? I just had to put a new motor in it and pay for it. And then I had to, and then let it go. You know, people talk to me, "Why don't you can appeal and call the mechanic." I can't afford the lack of sleep. anymore. Sleep's worth more to me than what I'm going to get from them when that takes place. So you like when you let God do it, when you say, you know what, that person mistreated me, and instead of being bitter and looking for a way to get back at them, I'm just going to let it go and I'm going to let God take care of it. You buy yourself peace. You buy yourself less wrinkles over time. You buy yourself some sleep, which is always a good thing when you let it go and when you understand that God's the one who will take care of it. God does it. Now, this is, verse 2 is a key to the rest of this chapter because God's is taking vengeance on them. God's acting as a judge. There are times in the Bible when God raised up like Nebuchadnezzar, brought Nebuchadnezzar into Israel as a judgment against Israel, and men, women, and children were killed by Nebuchadnezzar. But God said through Jeremiah, if you guys don't repent, I will raise him up and I will bring him into the land. God took responsibility for the death of all the men, women, and children and for them being taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. That's judgment. When we see Nebuchadnezzar, a wicked king, a Babylonian king, Iraq, from the area of Iraq, a Babylonian king, a king that dominated the world in those days, being used by God to bring judgment on a people where women and men and children die, we kind of can understand that. We might have questions about it. Why did God go that far? But we kind of understand it. God could use an event like he did with Sodom and Gomorrah. When God said to Abraham, I'm going to go and I'm going to see myself if the cry against these people is as bad as what it's been said. And Sodom and Gomorrah were killed because of their lack of taking care of the poor. They were so into pleasure that they neglected the poor. And they were killed because there was homosexuality that was there, but they were raping men who were sleeping in the courtyard. That's how they were how much they were mistreating people. And if they would rape men that would come into the courtyard and stay there, what would they doing to the women in their midst? There had been all of these wicked, evil cries that had gone out from it. And so God gave, you know, this kind of thing with Abraham. You know, if I can find whatever 10 righteous men in Sodom and Gomorrah, then I'll save it. He couldn't find 10, and he destroyed it. When he destroyed it, he destroyed men, women, and children, right? It's God's judgment on these people for what they were doing. You might say, well, the kids didn't do anything, but when the parents, when the adults made a decision, it affected their children. Their children's lives were affected when they made a decision to live in the wickedness that they lived in. There's a truth there that's powerful, and that is that our children's lives are affected by the decisions that we make. When we make decisions to live godly lives and to seek God and to live for him, then there's a blessing that's passed on to our children. So this is a spiritual thing. It's vengeance. It's God doing it. He's gonna go after these people. And then he says to Moses again the second time, I'm going to gather you to my people, to your people. He's telling Moses again that he's going to die. For the second time, God's told Moses he's going to die. And for the second time, Moses just goes about his work. The first time he said, well, if I'm going to die, then let's raise up somebody so these people can be cared for. Moses wasn't distraught when he found out that he was going to die. He faced it because he knew that he was going to be with the Lord. There's something. I had said it in our last study when we talked about this, when God told Moses that he was going to die. And I really believe it's true that your faith will never mean more to you here on earth or be as powerful in your life as when you face death. Whether it's your own death or the death of someone close to you. Your faith never means more to you or will never be more powerful in your life than during those times. Those are the most difficult and the hardest times that we face together. And it's then that our faith really matters. We've seen it with the people that have gone to be with the Lord. We've seen them face death with courage that is beyond anything you could possibly imagine, because they know Christ and they know that they're going to be with her. My late wife, who died almost 3 years ago, now December will be 3 years, she had a picture of heaven right by her bed where we had her hospital bed in. She had a picture of heaven. And I'll tell you that the worse she got, she even turned towards the picture. She literally turned towards the picture and was facing that picture on the morning that she went to be with the Lord. Moses just got, you know, you guys got some work to do, Moses. You're going to go to be with me or with your people. Read verse 2 again. Let's read verses 1 and 2. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take vengeance on the Midianites for the children of Israel. Afterwards, you shall be gathered to your people. So Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm some of yourselves for war and let them go against the Midianites to take vengeance for the Lord on Midian. Moses, you got some work to do. You're going to have to go out to war. You're going to have to go out to battle. And then you're going to go be with me. We always have work to do for the Lord. Christians don't really retire. You might slow down a little bit the older you get, right? The little tireder you get. I was thinking about that a while ago when I was kind of tired all day long. I was just tired. I thought, I never remember being tired as a kid. I look at my grandkids. They're never tired. They're just full of energy. See, the older you get, the tireder you get. Ministry may change, but God's always got something for you to do. God's always got something in your life. And he tells Moses, you got one more battle to do. So he gathers together the people and he says, you're going to go out to take vengeance for the Lord. Again, they are now the hand of God's judgment. They are like Nebuchadnezzar. They are like the fire and the brimstone that fell on Sodom and Gomorrah. 1,000 from each tribe, all of the tribes of Israel, you shall send to war. Now the Midianites were... They lived with the Moabites. So he's taking vengeance on the Midianites because of what Balak did when he sent the Moabite Midianite women down into the camp, had them seduce the men, and then had them worship false gods. So not only did the Israelite men commit idolatry, they committed adultery and fornication before the Lord, and the Lord sent a plague into their midst. And now God says, I'm going to take care of them. It's time for me to take care of him. Moses, before you go, this is business you gotta get wrapped up. So they were recruited, verse 5, from the divisions of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. And Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 for each tribe. He sent them to the war with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar. Now you remember that Phinehas had a part in stopping the plague that had hit Israel, because the Midianite women had been seducing the Israeli men and they were giving into it. That a man walked right by the gate of the tabernacle with a woman, kind of said something to Moses, flaunted it, and then walked into a tent, started having sex with her. And Phinehas was so angry. I love what John Corson says. He says Phinehas was so I can't remember how he said the joke, so I won't say it anymore. He said a joke here that was funny. You'll have to listen to it to find it. But Phinehas went in and killed them both with a spear. Right? And the plague stopped because he was zealous for the Lord. So Moses says, I'm going to send Phinehas out. He's the son of Eleazar, the priest, and he's going to go out in battle here. That's again, verse 6. 1,000 from each of the tribes, and he sent them to war with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, with the holy articles and the signal trumpets in his hand. So this is spiritual. This is a priest that's leading this battle. And for you and me, It is a sign of God taking vengeance on how Satan tempts us with his schemes. Satan comes into our lives and he tries to get us to fall. He can't attack us openly like Balak tried to attack Israel openly, the king of the Moabites, but he couldn't do it. So Balaam told him to send the Midianite women in. And so Satan, he kind of like throws lures in front of you. He's trying to get you to try. He's got a scheme that he's trying to get you trapped into. And here God says, I'm going to take care of these people who laid this scheme out for what they did against Israel. There's also some applications with that as we make our way through here. And they warned against the Midianites, just as the Lord commanded Moses. They warred against the Midianites, just as the Lord commanded Moses, and killed all of the males. The Midianites were not necessarily a warring people. 12,000 men armed for war from Israel went out against the Midianites and killed all of the males. They killed the kings of Midian, and the rest of those who were killed were Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the 5 kings of Midian. Balaam, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword. So this is our end of the story with Balaam. Balaam, the guy that stood on 3 different mountains and actually prophesied by the Spirit for God. Balaam, who had said, oh, that I would die the death of the righteous. He looked down on the camp of Israel and he said, I consider their end and oh, that I would die the death of the righteous. He didn't die the death of the righteous. He died with Israel marching in to wherever he was. Maybe he was in his little place where he read palms or whatever he did. And when he was there, the men came in and they found Balaam, the son of Beor, and they killed him. That was the end of his life. In order to live the death of have the death of the righteous, you have to live a life of the righteous. Or at least at the end of your life, you have to call out upon the name of the Lord like the thief on the cross. Remember me when you come into the kingdom. Today I tell you, truly you will be with me in paradise. Balaam didn't live the life of the righteous. He didn't die the death of the righteous. Even though at one point under the Spirit of God, he had said that he had wanted to. This is the end of the story. And boy, there's so much here. Balaam didn't have to go. When Balak showed up, Balaam could have said, nah, you know what? Money's not important to me. I'm not going to go and curse God's people, Jehovah's people. I don't think that Balaam was Jewish, by the way. But he could have said, I've heard of this God, and I would rather be on his side. There were a group of people who were not Jewish that were traveling with Israel. He could have gone and joined them. There were a lot of options for him. This didn't need to be his end. But this is his end because of the stand that he took against Israel with his schemes. And the children of Israel took the women of Midian captive. These are the very women that they had brought into their beds before. Now they take these women captive with the little ones, and they took the spoil, all the cattle and all the flocks and all the goods. They also burned with fire all of the cities where they dwelt and all of their forts. And they took all of the spoils and all the booty of men and beast. Then they brought the captives, the booty, and the spoil to Moses. And Eleazar the priest and the congregation of the children of Israel to the camp in the plains of Moab by Jordan across from Jericho. The word booty there is spoil, by the way. And new translations ought to change that word to spoils. And Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the leaders of the congregation went to meet him outside of the camp. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army and with the captains of the thousands and the captains of the hundreds who had come from the battle. And Moses said to them, have you kept all the women alive? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And there was a plague among the generation of the Lord, or the congregation of the Lord. I should really read the words that are in the text. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones and kill every woman who has known the man intimately, but keep alive for yourself all of the young girls who have not known a man intimately. And as for you, remain outside of the camp for 7 days. Now, there's the hard section in this passage. Like I said, I could just read by it and I could kind of ignore that it's there. But he says, Moses says to them, I want you to kill all these women. And then I want you to kill all the young boys that you've kept alive. They weren't yet men to fight in battle. And I want you to kill all these young boys. And then you can take the girls as servants. It's pretty brutal. In our day, for a group of people to go and do such a thing, we would go, well, that's just an absolutely horrible and awful thing to do. But this is God's judgment. This is God's vengeance. It is God who is God and God above all, who is giving judgment upon a people for what they have done. And the children of these kids are suffering like the children did in Sodom and Gomorrah, like the children did in Israel when the Babylonians marched upon them when children were killed. And I don't think we should make excuses for God. I think we ought to say, God will one day bring judgment. This world is coming to an end. And there is a time coming that is worse than any other time. And we'll see in Matthew 24, we're studying on Sunday mornings, that there's going to be a day when flesh is rare. Flesh becomes rare upon the earth as part of God's indignation and wrath and judgment upon the earth. This is the God that we serve, the God who is merciful, the God who is gracious, the God who went to the cross, the God who made a way, the God who is love, and the God who is just. We sing a song here at the church that says, at the cross, you showed your love and your justice. His justice was met by the death of Jesus, and his love was revealed because he would die for us. But had he not died, then we would have to die for our sins. Our children would have to die. Everyone has to die. It is difficult. It's hard. But this is whom God is. God is the judge of the universe. And I want to know the one true living God. I want to know the real God. I don't want to know the God that we make up or the God that we fashion towards our own, out of our own mind or out of our own culture. I want to know who the real God is. This is who he is. He's a judge. and he will one day take vengeance on everyone. He's the same one who's full of goodness and grace and mercy and has an open arm. These guys made decisions that affected them and their children. The Midianites didn't have to do it. They were the Midianites, the Moabites, were a non-warring people. Archaeologists tell us that they were farmers. They were people that were ranchers. They were not people who went out in war and in battle, but they thought when they saw Israel coming, we better get them. And they could have made a different decision. They could have opened up their hearts to them. They could have welcomed them as neighbors, but they didn't do it. And so they took the road to try to destroy Israel, and God takes vengeance on them. Now, it goes on to say here then, verse 19, and as for you, remain outside of the camp for 7 days. Whoever has killed a person and whoever has touched his slain, purify yourself and your captives on the third day and on the seventh day. Purify every garment, everything made by leather, everything woven by goat's hair, and everything made by wool. Then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to the battle, this is the ordinance of the law of the Lord, commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver, the bronze and the iron, the tin, the lead, everything that can endure fire, you shall put through the fire, and it shall be clean, and it shall be purified with the water of purification. But all that cannot endure fire with fire, you shall purify through water. And you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day and be clean, and afterwards you shall come into the camp. So all of this is fulfilling the purification laws after the army had touched a dead body. Now, let's go back a little bit. I don't know what was going on in these men's mind when they kept the women and brought them into camp. But these women, they had seduced them before, and there was something about it that I would think that they still were drawn to them. And so they kept them alive and they brought them back with them. So I don't know. I can't really judge them as to what was going on in their heart, but I have certain suspicions as to what they were thinking. And all of these things are an example to us, right? That's what it says in Corinthians. These things that happen to them as an example to us. When we want to overcome the very things that destroy us, the next chapter, which we're not going to get to tonight, has a statement that says your sin will find you out. We'll talk about that next week. It's not God saying, I'm going to get you for your sin. It's saying your sin will find you out. These guys had certain things in mind. They weren't willing to take the steps, or they didn't take the steps they needed to really purify themselves completely. And it's like when we half-heartedly serve God. We don't follow him with everything. We kind of keep something back from him. We hold something back from him and don't give all of it to him for whatever reason. And we justify it instead of giving it all. When I was a youth pastor in Calvary Chapel of Albuquerque, this is back in the early 80s now, one girl came and talked to me after one of our youth meetings, and she had found a Playboy in her dad's house. Her dad was an elder in the church. And so I went and talked to her dad. I thought, well, let me go talk to him first before I go to Skip and talk to Skip about it. And I eventually did tell Skip just because I felt like they needed to know. And even though he did repent. But he said, when I talked to him, he said, yeah, it was a weak moment, and I ordered them, and I have them come into a P.O. box, and I don't know what to do. And I said, well, cancel them. Well, they won't give me my money back. How does that mean? So you're going to get the magazine because you can't get your money back? What kind of thinking is that? But I think there was some kind of a justification. Well, I'm not going to get my money back, so I might as well get the magazines, because otherwise I'm out the money. Just be out the money. Just make the sacrifice. If in a weak moment you do something and you find that there's some kind of a compromise in your life, then you got to clean the compromise up completely. You can't bring the women back into the camp. You can't keep the women and bring them into the camp. You got to clean it out completely. And I think that's what this chapter is telling us. That as we look at these, our examples, so that we don't do what they did, the thing that they wouldn't do is get rid of the compromise completely. They kept some compromise in their lives. Now we have the division of the plunder through the rest of it. And I've got a few minutes here, so let's read through here. I think we can make it through here. I've got until 7:15, so let me finish it up. And there's a spiritual principle here in the plunder as well. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, count up the plunder that was taken of man and beast, you and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts, between those who took part in the war and went out of the battle, and all the congregation, and levy a tribute to the Lord on the man of war who went out to battle, and one of every 5,000 of the persons of cattle and donkey and sheep. Take it from their half and give to Eleazar the priest as a heave offering to the Lord. And from the children of Israel, half you shall take one of every 50 drawn from a person of the cattle and donkeys and the sheep from all the livestock and give them to the Levites to keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So Moses and Eleazar the priest did as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, they're dividing the spoil. And of the 12,000 men that went out to battle, they got half of it. And of the rest of the children of Israel that stayed behind, the counting men alone, the some 600 and something thousand of them, they get the other half of it. And then for every 50 men, they have to pay something to God. They have to go and give an offering to God. And out of the 12,000, for every 50 men, they have to give something to God. But half of the spoil between 12,000 men is every man that went to battle got a lot more than the people who didn't go to battle. They got blessings from it, but they didn't get as much blessings from it as the people who went out to battle. And they didn't have to give as much of it up in the sacrifice when it comes percentage-wise. And again, I think there's a spiritual principle here. I think that we want to be a part of what God's doing. I think we just naturally want to be a part of what God's doing. I think there's something God-given that I want to be a part of the work of God. I don't want to just sit by and not see God use me and not be used by God. But you could do that. You could go, you know, I'm not going to witness. I'll live for him. I'll go to church. And I don't really want to do anything for him. Well, just not going to get as much of the blessing. It's not that you're not going to get blessing. You're going to get blessing. God will bless you. It's not that you're not going to get blessed. It's just that there's a real blessing in doing the work of the Lord. There's a real blessing in saying, whatever you want me to do, God, I'm here. I'm ready. Use me. However you want to use me. You want to use me in great ways, use me in great ways. You want to use me as a servant to clean up after somebody, then I'll be a servant to clean up after somebody. But I want to be a part of what you're doing. So the people that went out to battle got to share in the spoils more than the people who remained, although everybody shared in it. It says in verse 32, the booty remaining from the plunder which the men of war had taken was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all of the women who had not known men intimately. And the half, the portion for those who had gone out to war, was in number 337,500 sheep. The Lord's tribute of the sheep was 675. That's why this book is called the Book of Numbers, because there's numbers like this in there, which in the end, you and I go, doesn't really matter to me how many each person got. The cattle were, but for some reason, God wants us to know, the cattle were 36,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 72. The donkeys were 13,500, of which the Lord's tribute was 61. The persons were 16,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 32 persons. So Moses gave a tribute, which was the Lord's heave offering to Eleazar the priest, as the Lord had commanded Moses. And from the children of Israel's half, which Moses separated for the men who fought, now the half belonging to the congregation was 337,500, 36,000 cattle, 30,500 donkeys, and 16,000 persons. And from the children of Israel's half, Moses took one of every 50 drawn from men and beast and gave them to the Levites who kept charge of the tabernacle of the Lord as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then the officers who were over the thousands of the armies of the captains of the thousands and the captains of the hundreds who came near to Moses, they said to him, your servants have taken a count of the men of war who were under our command, and not a man was missing. Therefore, we have brought an offering to the Lord with every man found of ornaments of gold, of armlets, of bracelets, of signets, and of earrings and necklaces to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. So they were stunned. as we are. Out of the 12,000 men that went into battle, I mean, these weren't, again, they weren't a warring people, but that no one would die, that nobody would sneak up behind one of them and kill them. Well, that's supernatural. Some people say, well, that just can't be done. Well, the Bible's full of a lot of supernatural. I don't know if you noticed that or not. Starting from verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It's been said, if you can't believe that, you're going to have trouble with a lot of the other that's in it. I think, again, there's a spiritual principle here. That when you go into battle, when you take a step out for God, God will take care of you. This whole thing is a spiritual principle. They're going out to do this as vengeance for the Lord, and not one of them was lost. And so they wanted to come and bring a tribute to God and give God something, because it was pretty spectacular to them that none of them were lost. The men of war had taken spoils, every man for himself, it says. And Moses and Eleazar, verse 54, the priest received the gold from the captains of the thousands and the hundreds and brought it into the tabernacle of meeting as a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord. So it became part of the wealth that was kept in the temple that they had given unto God. And again, all of this becomes an example to us. There's a lot of principles in these two chapters. We covered it quickly, but men and women of our word, let's make sure if we bind ourselves, we keep our word. Don't bind yourself. By the way, I think we could talk about debt there too, couldn't we? We could say, let's try to stay as much out of debt as we possibly can. Because when we take a vow to pay something, we got to pay it. It's easier to pay it when we're not in debt. It's a good thing to be as out of debt as we can.